This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yi Swu Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Once the temperatures really started to get low over the weekend, and we're talking about temperatures that are well below freezing, -5, -6 degrees in the Calais area, the government has opened up special areas which they have been transporting migrants to.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Full details coming up.
Also, Kenyan authorities lifted the nearly week-long suspension of two independent TV stations cut last Tuesday. And residents of Cape Town, South Africa, are being restricted to just 50 liters of water each day.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Kenyan authorities lifted the suspension of two independent TV stations forced off the air last Tuesday to prevent live coverage of opposition leader Raila Odinga's self-inauguration. A third station remained off the air as of late today. There was no immediate reaction from authorities or the broadcasters. Rayal Ambor reports from Nairobi, where civil society groups marched today to protest the media blackout.
The demonstration, dubbed Not in My Country, brought hundreds of protesters to the streets of Nairobi. They marched against what they say is a government turned rogue. International Commission of Jurists country chairman Njonjo Mue helped organize the protests.
We have seen violations of human rights, freedom of information, in addition to all the other things that Kenyans are struggling with, particularly a collapsing economy, youth unemployment, and so on. And instead of the government offering leadership, bringing people together to discuss how we might find our way out of these issues, they are becoming increasingly autocratic.
The government cut the transmission for the country's three largest independent broadcasters last Tuesday to prevent live coverage of opposition leader Raila Odinga's swearing-in ceremony. The interior minister later called the event treasonous and accused the opposition and the so-called complicit media of trying to subvert the government and spark deadly riots. The communications authority defied a court order Thursday to lift the media suspension. In addition to the media blackout, three opposition members have been arrested. One of the politicians detained, Miguna Miguna, was due to appear in court Monday, but did not show up, sparking concern. The demonstrators marched Monday past a stone monument called Freedom's Corner, a memorial to those who suffered abuses in the colonial era. Protester George Kerogo is the executive director of the Kenya National Human Rights Commission.
We are here to put the government on notice that this monument shows that Kenyans have always stood up against repression. Kenyans have always stood up against dictatorship.
Hours after Odinga took his symbolic public oath as the people's president, the government declared his National Resistance Movement a criminal organization. The NRM was formed last year to reject the results of the October rerun of the presidential runoff, which Odinga boycotted. The Supreme Court validated the victory of incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. Odinga maintains that he won the original vote in August. The past week has seen both sides dig in. Months after perhaps the most contentious election in Kenya's history, the country remains divided. Rael Ombord for VOA News, Nairobi.
One of the world's top investigators into the illegal ivory and rhino horn trade has been killed. Esmond Bradley Martin was found in his home with a stab wound in his neck Sunday in Nairobi. The 75-year-old American was known for undercover work that resulted in exposing ivory traffickers and markets. Wildlife Director Paul Kahumbu said Martin's research helped uncover ivory traders in the United States, Congo, Vietnam, Nigeria, Angola, China, and recently Myanmar. His work was essential in China's decision to stop the rhino horn trade in 1993. Martin's research also helped persuade China to end its legal ivory sales, a ban that went into effect January 1st.
Supporters and critics of South Africa's President Jacob Zuma held a dueling protest today ahead of a meeting by top officials of his African National Congress Party. At the meeting, the ANC leadership is expected to discuss Zuma's political fate. Zuma, president since 2009, is in the final year of his last term. The president, a veteran of the anti-apartheid campaign that ended white minority rule in the 1990s, is increasingly unpopular. His administration has been tainted by several corruption scandals. Party leaders met with Zuma yesterday, but have made no public statements about the outcome of the meeting. Many of his critics want Zuma to step down or be forced out of office to let his deputy Cyril Ramaphosa finish his term. The ANC elected Ramaphosa the party head late last year.
Residents of Cape Town, South Africa, are being restricted to just 50 liters of water each day. They must use the reduced amount for all bathing, cooking, and cleaning. The region is in the grip of a crippling drought, with reservoir levels running dangerously low. Local authorities warn residents to restrict their water usage to stave off what they are calling day zero. That's the day the taps are expected to run dry. For now, it's set for May 11th. Nadia Sami reports.
Cape Town's dams are 26% full. That's critically low, taking into consideration the last 10% of water cannot be used for human consumption. The main causes of the problem are months of poor rainfall and the fact that desalination plants are yet to come online fully. The onus is on residents to drastically cut back their usage and reuse water whenever possible. Dolores Jacobs lives in the city and describes how she's changed her behavior.
Well, we've started taking short showers, and we use a bucket in the shower to catch all the water, and we use that water in the toilet or in the garden. Well, the plants that I have at the back, because I don't have a garden anymore, because I can't use the water for the garden. It's like a little desert out there. We try to save as much as we can.
Access to sufficient water is a basic human right as enshrined in the South African Constitution. But the situation in Cape Town is so dire, even the South African Human Rights Commission is monitoring it to ensure all spheres of government work together to avoid a crisis. Households that go above the 50-liter or 13-gallon allocation per person are receiving steep fines. Jacob says the situation is particularly frustrating as authorities don't seem to be taking their own advice.
Well, just today we went to the beach, and when we got to the beach there, the council, they were actually watering the grass. And they're using sprinklers, but they're wanting us to save water, but they don't set an example for us.
Most residents are terrified at the prospect of day zero, when household taps will run dry and they will have to queue at one of 200 water collection points for their daily ration. City of Cape Town mayoral member JP Smith explains how day zero is calculated.
As soon as we reach the 13.5 trigger point for the dam level, that means that we have enough water, if we ration it carefully, to last us for 3 months. If you look at the anticipated day zero date in April, and you look at the anticipated time for rains and the first augmentation schemes to kick in, then that's the period we have to cover.
At that time, water supply to the retail, industrial and commercial hubs, as well as hospitals, will be maintained. But Smith says it's still possible to avoid day zero if residents continue to reduce their consumption, as seen in the past week. In the coming months, 3 desalination plants are scheduled to start producing usable water. But the deadlines are tight and the government's been criticized for failing to adequately plan, despite early warnings from scientists that Cape Town's demand for water would outstrip supply. The Cape Town government, led by the Democratic Alliance, is also attributing the problem to the national government, led by the African National Congress. The blame game has gone back and forth to residents' frustration.
So I think we're all well aware of the level of the crisis. The problem is that it's not local government's constitutional competency or within our financial capability to expand the bulk water capacity. That's a national government competency.
Citizens around the country have been extending a helping hand. In Johannesburg, Kellyanne van der Meer put out a call on social media for donations of bottled water for animal shelters in the parched mother city. Now she stands in her garden, surrounded by thousands of bottles of water, ready to be packed into trucks, which will then make the 16-hour journey by road to the Cape.
As of yesterday, we collected 69 tons of water. That is 69,000 litres. It's incredible.
Demure says she now views her own water usage in an entirely different light.
I must be honest, I've become more water conscious. You know, when you wash dishes and you leave your tap running, you land up in your head, you're going, oh goodness, I'm wasting. And you tend to switch things off and use less bath water to bath in and try and collect grey water from the shower. It's just a case of if each of us did our little bit, it would make such a big difference.
Water scarcity has been a tough lesson to learn, especially for Capetonians who are surrounded by oceans. It's a city that, at first glance, has a seemingly endless supply of water, reminding one of the rhyme of the ancient mariner. Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
Tensions continue to climb in the Anglophone regions of Cameroon as separatist groups demand the release of their leader and 47 other prisoners extradited last month from Nigeria. The government has sought to reassure the population. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the English-speaking town of Mabingo in northwestern Cameroon.
A woman and her husband cry at the Baptist Hospital mortuary in the English-speaking town of Bingo in northwestern Cameroon. The woman has just discovered the lifeless bodies of her younger brother and three others she says were arrested last Wednesday, accused of killing two gendarmes. She refuses to grant an interview, but workers of the hospital told VOA the bodies were brought there by unidentified men. The so-called Anglophone crisis began in Cameroon over a year ago, sparking bouts of deadly unrest and, more recently, clashes between alleged separatist militants and security forces. The Anglophone community in Cameroon is protesting political and economic discrimination in the majority French-speaking country. Joseph Banadzem, lawmaker from the Northwest region, says the military is responding by violently cracking down on the population.
The army, who are supposed to maintain law and order, to protect property, to protect lives, go on the rampage in villages, burning houses, burning foodstuff, people's stores and so on, all ransacked. It is unbelievable. It is unacceptable. It is inhuman.
Colonel Didier Bajek is a spokesperson for Cameroon's military. He says the military is committed to preserving Cameroon's territorial integrity.
Je voudrais bien dire que c'est pas les Amazoniens qui vont nous dépasser. Tous les conflits au début.
He says the armed separatists are using mercenaries and carrying out abuses on the population, whom he says will very soon understand that they have to trust only the country's military. Violence has escalated since January when Nigeria detained and then extradited separatist leader Ayuk Tabe Julius and the 46 other alleged separatists to Cameroon. The separatist groups are demanding their leaders be released. At least four schools have been burned as of last Friday, and at least 12 people have been killed, according to local media, which report unconfirmed casualties among both armed separatists and soldiers. Many businesses remain closed in the two English-speaking regions amid fears of more violence. The 47 detainees extradited from Nigeria have not been seen in public. International human rights groups warned against the extradition, saying the detainees could face torture or worse. Nigeria is now also facing criticism from the United Nations Refugee Agency, which said that most of those handed over to Cameroon had applied for asylum in Nigeria and their forcibly returned violated Nigeria's international obligations. On Friday, Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma issued a press release saying the detainees are safe and would be appearing in front of the law courts soon. He did not comment on the charges they would answer. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mbingo, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Kenyan authorities lifted the nearly week-long suspension of two independent TV stations cut last Tuesday. The ANC leadership today is expected to discuss South African President Jacob Zuma's political fate. And tensions continue to climb in the Anglophone regions of Cameroon as separatist groups demand the release of their leader. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
France's government has reopened housing for migrants in the Calais area due to freezing temperatures. Hundreds of migrants have been rounded up and brought to unused hangars and containers where they will be kept warm and will have a bed to sleep on. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me about the migrant situation during the cold months and why they continue to flock to Calais.
Once the temperatures really started to get low over the weekend, and we're talking about temperatures that are well below freezing, -5, -6 degrees in the Calais area, the government has opened up special areas which they have been transporting migrants to. Now, this includes two hangars, two disused hangars. They can house around 310 migrants there. And they've opened up these specially adapted containers, which can accommodate around 85 in each container. Now, these containers were brought to the area when the jungle was dismantled, this huge, big jungle that accommodated some 10,000 people. When that was dismantled more than a year ago, these containers were put there. Now, they've been disused for the last couple of months. The government has reopened them. Also, for any other unaccompanied minors who cannot find a place in either the containers or the hangars, the police are transporting them to these actual proper centres inside the town of Calais, and there they will be fed and housed and perhaps even start putting through the paperwork to get their situation in France regularised.
What do the containers, what are they made of and what is inside of them?
These are huge metal shipping containers, and inside of them there are different areas that are laid out with beds. They're all divided up so each person sleeping in there has a bed, able to have a shower there. They have, in fact, their own cubicle. Police are also taking very seriously the security, so they have very large security around the outskirts of these containers just to make sure that there is no return to the violence we've seen. The main criteria for them at the moment is to get these migrants, which there are between 600 and 800 in the Calais region at the moment, get these migrants inside in the warm and give them a meal.
And also, if you could provide us on an update on the four Eritreans that were shot last week, last Thursday, actually, they were in the hospital. What's the latest on them?
These four Eritreans aged between 16 and 18, they are still in hospital. Authorities say that their health has stabilized. They're no longer in any grave danger, but they are still being treated in hospital. Police are also still searching for the man they believe fired those shots at close range. It's a apparently a 37-year-old Afghani. We're still getting conflicting information as to whether or not this person was actually part of the people traffickers or whether he was a migrant himself. Either way, it has rekindled the debate in Calais between the authorities and between some of the locals who resent the presence of these migrants there, saying, look, if the charities weren't there giving out the food, then the migrants wouldn't come there. The mayor of Calais is saying, look, we have to feed these people. We cannot let them starve on our streets. So this has now moved on in a big way, and particularly with the government bringing the migrants into accommodation, put more pressure on them to actually deal with the problem there of get these people, get them in, and get their paperwork done. For their part, the charities are saying, look, the announcement that was made in mid-January that the processing of the documentation would be accelerated, this has put more pressure on people to go to Calais, because they seem to be under the impression that if you go to Calais, your paperwork will be seen to and you'll be processed within a couple of weeks. And they say that isn't the case. Nevertheless, at least 200 more people have arrived in the Calais area in the last 2 weeks.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris.
Israel has begun issuing deportation notices to thousands of African migrants. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Some 40,000 African migrants are facing an uncertain future after Israel began issuing deportation orders that amount to an ultimatum. The migrants can take an offer of $3,500 and a one-way plane ticket to Rwanda within 60 days or face imprisonment. Most of the migrants came from war-torn Sudan and Eritrea over the past decade and entered Israel illegally. Many say that going back to Africa is not an option, so they will choose the lesser of the two evils. I will go to prison in Israel, said Katir Abdullah, who came from Darfur. He said Rwanda is not his country, and the only things waiting for him there are persecution, unemployment, and poverty. Israel is sending the migrants to Rwanda after assessing it as a safe country with a growing economy. Rwanda denies Israeli claims that it has agreed to take the migrants in. Adam Ahmed, who is from Sudan, says paying people to leave is a betrayal.
Now it is so sad that Israeli people, they put African people or African asylum seekers for sale, and that's so sad.
Israel refuses to grant the Africans asylum, saying that they are economic migrants and not refugees. Officials say Israel was created as a refuge for the Jewish people and not for the masses fleeing poverty in Africa. Interior Minister Aryeh Deri said Israel's first obligation is to its own people. He described the Africans as infiltrators who have brought crime and misery to the streets of South Tel Aviv. But human rights activists here say Israel should be the first to assist the Africans because the country was built by Jewish refugees fleeing the Holocaust. Colette Avital heads the Center of Organizations of Holocaust Survivors in Israel. We have always asserted that the world was silent during World War II, said Avital. She warned that Israel must not be silent and must lend a helping hand to those in need. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, political tensions simmer in Kenya as opposition leader Raila Odinga takes a symbolic presidential oath of office as the people's president, despite warnings from the nation's attorney general, who called the mock swearing-in of Odinga an act of treason. An in-depth look at Kenya's political future on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.